Okay, I want you to close your eyes for a second. Imagine you're back in the early 1960s. You turn on the radio and you hear that sound. You know the one. It's high, it's piercing, it's just undeniable.
The falsetto.
Exactly. Sherry, Big Girls Don't Cry, Walk Like a Man. The Four Seasons, they are just absolutely everywhere. And if you look at their album covers or, you know, see them on The Ed Sullivan Show, what do you see?
Four guys, matching suits, perfect hair.
The moves are all synchronized. You'd think now there is a wholesome, squeaky clean American success story.
It's the image of the perfect pop group. I mean, totally safe, polished, radio-friendly, the kind of boys you could bring home to mom.
Right. But here's where it gets really, really interesting and frankly, a little dark. Because that image, it was a complete
Or at
fabrication.
least a very carefully constructed mask.
Yeah. I mean, underneath those matching suits and that perfect harmony, you had prison records, you had massive gambling debts, and you had genuine sit-down meetings with organized crime bosses just to keep the band alive.
It's such a paradox.
Yeah.
And that paradox is exactly what we're unpacking today. We're doing a deep dive into Jersey Boys.
Yes. The musical that just took Broadway by storm and is still touring the world. But we aren't just, you know, reviewing a show here. We're looking at the source material, the incredible, true, and often contradictory history of the four seasons that this show brought to light.
And it's such a fascinating case study in storytelling. Because Jersey Boys isn't just a jukebox musical where they shove some songs into a flimsy plot.
Not at all.
No, it's essentially a documentary-style drama that exposed a history the band had kept hidden for, what, 40 years?
It's the classic rags to riches story, but as one of the creators put it, it's rags to riches and back to rags.
And that's the key. So let's start with how this thing even came to be. Because for a long, long time, the members of the Four Seasons, specifically Bob Gaudio and Frankie Valli, had been trying to do something with their life story, but they were so protective of it.
Right, and our sources say they had ideas as far back as the mid-90s.
They did. But they kept getting these offers for, like, television movies, you know, movies of the week, and they just felt that format wouldn't do the band justice. They did not want the cheesy biopic treatment.
So what changed?
Well, fast forward to the early 2000s, and Bob Gaudio, he was the songwriter, the keyboardist, basically the business brains of the whole operation. He sees the massive success of Mamma Mia.
And he thinks, okay, a rock and roll musical with existing songs can actually work.
Exactly. But there was a major difference in philosophy. Mamma Mia took ABBA songs and, I mean, let's be honest, shoehorned them into a completely fictional story about a wedding on a Greek island.
It was fluff, fun fluff, but fluff.
Totally. But Marshall Brickman, one of the writers they brought on for Jersey Boys, he insisted on doing the complete opposite.
And Marshall Brickman isn't exactly a musical theater guy, is he?
Far from it.
Yeah.
This is the guy who co-wrote Annie Hall in Manhattan with Woody Allen. He's a serious screenwriter.
Well.
So he looked at the band's actual history and said, "We don't need to make anything up. The real story, the mob, the debt, the breakup, that's a classic American story."
Which brings us to the structure of the show, which I think is just brilliant. It's not a straight line, start to finish. It's built around this concept called the Rashomon effect.
This is one of the smartest things the writers, Rick Elise and Marshall Brickman, did. When they started interviewing the surviving members, Gaudio, Valli, and Tommy DeVito, they realized something really important.
That they couldn't agree on anything.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
These guys did not agree on what happened.
Memory is a tricky thing.
It is, especially when you're talking about things from 40 years ago that involve, you know, crime and a lot of money. They had totally different takes on the same events. And instead of trying to smooth that over to find one objective truth, the writers just leaned right into it.
They use the Rashomon effect.
Yeah. And for anyone who might not be a film buff, can we maybe unpack that term?
Sure. It comes from this 1950 Akira Kurosawa film, Rashomon. And in that movie, a single crime is described by four different witnesses, and every single version is completely different because of their own biases and egos.
And Jersey Boys adopts this structure perfectly. The show is divided into four seasons.
Right. Spring, summer, fall, winter.
And each season is narrated by a different band member, giving you their specific, you know, their version of the history.
I love that quote from Tommy DeVito in the notes. He apparently told the writers, "Don't listen to those guys. I'll tell you what really happened."
And that was the eureka moment for them. That contradiction became the engine of the whole show. It just admits that when you're talking about a band with this much drama, the truth really depends on who you ask.
So Tommy narrates the spring, the gritty start. Bob Gaudio gets the summer, the success. Nick Massey gets the fall, the unraveling. Frankie Valli gets winter.
Exactly. And speaking of that gritty formation, we have to talk about the name. Jersey Boys. It feels so iconic now, but apparently, the director, Dismekanoff, he wasn't sold on it at first.
He wasn't. McAnuff is a heavyweight in the theater world, and he really disliked the idea of using one of their song titles. He worried it would just look like a cash grab instead of, you know, a legitimate piece of theater.
So where did it come from?
It was Bob Gaudio. He came up with Jersey Boys on a plane ride. And his reasoning was simple. At the end of the day, they weren't art school kids like the Beatles. They were just a bunch of guys from the neighborhood.
Sometimes the simple answer is the best one.
Okay, but let's get to the really juicy stuff. You mentioned that the band hid their past. When the writers started digging, what they found actually shocked them.
Oh, it was a total revelation. You have to remember the context of the 1960s. I mean, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, they had a certain edge, sure, but the Four Seasons were marketed as completely clean cut.
And the magazines back then, like Tiger Beat, they didn't really cover them in depth?
Not at all. They were just the hit makers. So the public had no idea about the rap sheets.
None. The writers discovered that members had prison records for burglary, breaking, and entering. In the early 60s, if that had come out, it would have been career-ending.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Radio stations would have dropped them instantly.
It's wild to think about. Bob Gaudio is quoted saying the idea of their story getting out back then was just horrifying to them. They were terrified.
And for good reason. It wasn't just petty theft. We are talking about genuine ties to organized crime.
This is the part that blows my mind. The character Gyp DiCarlo. He's not a made-up character.
No, Gyp DiCarlo was a real-life mob boss, a capo in the Genovese crime family.
Yeah.
In the show and in real life, he sort of acts as this problem solver for the band. There's a scene where Frankie falls for a fake murder scam, and Tommy has to call DiCarlo to defuse the whole thing.
It's like something straight out of The Sopranos.
It's funny you say that. A lot of the original cast actually ended up in The Sopranos later on because they fit that archetype so perfectly. Yeah. But the mob connection was so real that the writers actually had to contact Gyp DiCarlo's family when they were developing the musical just to make sure he was portrayed respectfully.
That is a phone call I would not want to make. Hi, we're writing a musical about the mobster in your family. Is that okay?
Laughs. Well, it seems to have worked out. The family was apparently touched that he was shown as a human being who loved music, not just, you know, some two-dimensional villain.
But the mob ties weren't just for protection. They became necessary because of one person, Tommy DeVito.
Ah, yeah. We need to unpack the Tommy DeVito situation because in the show, he's the real driver of all the conflict. He's the one who gets them into so much debt.
And debt is putting it mildly. This is the climax of Act One and really the beginning of the end for the original lineup. Tommy was a degenerate gambler. He had racked up a huge amount of debt with loan sharks.
And we have a specific number here in the research. It was $150,000.
$150,000 in the 60s. That's a fortune.
It's huge. Adjusted for inflation, that's well over $1 million today. But it gets so much worse.
How?
Well, when the loan shark confronts the band, they calculate the total, including the vigorish, that's the insane interest, illegal lenders charge, plus unpaid taxes that Tommy had just squandered. The total came to $662,000.
Wait, hold on. $662,000 in, like, 1965? That is astronomical.
In today's money, you were looking at roughly $6.5 million. The band was, on paper, the biggest act in the country. And they were completely bankrupt.
That's an impossible situation. And the way they solve it is one of the most compelling parts of their story. It wasn't a lawyer or a manager who fixed it. It was a sit-down.
A literal sit-down. The band, the loan shark, and the mob boss. And the agreement they reached effectively broke up the group. The mob decided that Tommy DeVito had to go to Las Vegas and stay there under their, basically, house arrest.
Wow. And Frankie Valli and Bob Gaudio agreed to take on the debt themselves.
Yeah. That explains so much, right? It explains why Frankie Valli was touring constantly for decades, playing state fairs and casinos. He was paying off a debt that wasn't even his.
It speaks to this profound sense of loyalty, or maybe entrapment, depending on how you look at it. He worked his way back to zero from a $6 million hole.
It's incredible.
Now, despite all this heaviness, the mob, the debt, this is still a musical, and the way the music is used is so clever. It's not just, and now we sing a song because we are sad.
Right. In a traditional musical, a character sings to express their inner thoughts.
Oh.
In Jersey Boys, the performance is the plot. They're almost always singing to an audience in a club, studio, a concert. But the songs also serve as these huge emotional markers.
Take Sherry, for example.
Sherry is the breakthrough. In the show, Bob Gaudio writes it like 15 minutes before a recording session. It captures that lightning in a bottle moment where everything changes for them. It's pure manic energy.
And then you have the really heartbreaking stuff like My Eyes Adored You.
That song is used to show Frankie's marriage to his first wife, Mary, just falling apart.
Huh.
The lyric, Though I Never Laid a Hand on You, takes on a whole different meaning in the show. It's about his absence. He was never home because he was always touring.
It grounds the pop hit in a very personal, painful reality. And then, maybe the most tragic moment, Fallen Angel.
Which covers the death of his daughter, Francine.
She died very young, right?
Yeah, from a drug overdose in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
The show really doesn't shy away from the cost of that fame. Frankie was on the road constantly to pay off those mob debts. And that absence, it had real consequences at home.
It's a heavy moment. And, you know, you mentioned the sound of the music, and recreating that specific four-season sound live on stage is not easy. It's not just a standard rock band.
No, it requires a very specific technical setup. The score calls for a small orchestra, but the instrumentation is key. They use specific doubling of woodwinds to get that unique texture.
What does that mean, doubling?
It means the musicians are playing multiple instruments or using synthesizers to layer sounds. The goal was to replicate that sort of compressed sound of a 1960s vinyl record. They didn't want it to sound like a modern Broadway pit orchestra. They wanted it to sound thin and punchy, like it was coming out of a transistor radio.
So you have this gritty true story. You have these iconic songs and this unique Rashomon structure. And it worked. I mean, it really, really worked.
It was a phenomenon. It premiered at La Jolla Playhouse in 2004. And by 2005, it was on Broadway. It ran for 11 years, over 4,600 performances.
It was the 12th longest running show on Broadway at one point. That is just huge.
And the critics loved it just as much as audiences. You had Ben Brantley from the New York Times, who was notoriously tough on jukebox musicals, writing that the audience seemed to forget the actors weren't the real band. He said the curtain call felt as real and vivid as the sting of your hands clapping together.
That's high praise, and it swept the awards, right?
Oh, yeah. Four Tonys in 2006, including Best Musical, a Grammy for the cast album, an Olivier Award in London. It translated globally, too. It's been performed in Dutch, Japanese, Korean.
Wait, Japanese? There's a Japanese version of Jersey Boys?
Absolutely. There's even a JBB vocal unit formed by the Japanese cast members. They tour and perform the songs.
That is fascinating. It just shows how universal that story is. You don't have to be from New Jersey to understand loyalty, debt, and, you know, trying to escape your neighborhood.
Exactly. The themes just resonate everywhere.
However, with great success comes legal battles.
Inevitably.
I found this story about the Midtown Men really interesting because it feels so meta.
It's the ultimate irony, right? So four of the original Broadway cast members, Christian Hoff, Michael Longoria, Daniel Reichert, and J. Robert Spencer, they had incredible chemistry. After they left the show, they decided, hey, let's keep singing these songs together on tour.
They called themselves the Boys in Concert at first.
Right. And Frankie Valli, Bob Gaudio, and the writers were not happy about it. They sued them.
They sued the actors who made them famous on Broadway.
They did. The claim was that the actors were using the Jersey Boys brand, the moves, the vibe, the association, without permission. They argued it would confuse the audience into thinking it was some official spinoff.
So the guys pretending to be the Four Seasons got sued by the actual Four Seasons for pretending to be the Four Seasons too well.
Laughs. Essentially, yes. The actors actually countersued, claiming it was bully tactics. Eventually, it was all settled out of court. The group rebranded as the Midtown Men, and they're still active. But it really shows how protective the creators are of this property.
They are not letting the vigorish pile up on them again.
Never again. They learned their lesson.
Speaking of the property, we've also seen it on screen. There was the 2014 film directed by Clint Eastwood.
Which was a little polarizing. Eastwood tried to keep that fourth wall breaking from the stage show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having actors talk directly to the camera. Some people felt it worked. Others felt it just killed the momentum.
But he did cast John Lloyd Young from the Broadway show as Frankie Valli.
Which was smart. It preserved a truly iconic performance. And now there's a pro shot, a filmed stage version, in the works with Nick Jonas as Frankie.
Nick Jonas, huh?
Yeah. He actually has a theater background from Les Miserables, so he's got the chops. It's a smart move to keep the legacy alive for a new generation.
So when we look back at Jersey Boys, what's the big takeaway here? We started by saying it's not just another jukebox musical.
I think it's a correction of the record. For decades, the Four Seasons were just those guys in the suits singing Sherry. Jersey Boys stripped away that glamour to show the blue-collar, sometimes criminal struggle that was happening underneath it all. It proved that the story behind the music was just as compelling as the hits themselves.
It makes you wonder, doesn't it, if you look at other clean-cut icons from that era, or any era, really.
Were they hiding?
Exactly. How many other polished pop stars have a Gip to Carlo in their past, or a massive debt, or a prison record that just never made it into the magazines?
The media landscape was so different then, you could control the narrative. Today, everything gets out. But back then, you could absolutely live a double life.
And that brings us right back to that idea of perspective, the Rashomon effect.
That is the thought that lingers for me. Since the whole show is built on four narrators who all contradict each other, do we ever actually know the true story of the Four Seasons?
Or do we just know the version that sounded best on a Broadway stage?
History is written by the victors, or in this case, by the ones holding the microphone.
Something to think about the next time you hear Big Girls Don't Cry. That's all for this deep dive into Jersey Boys. Thanks for listening.
See you next time.